Hello and welcome to Cutting Through the Matrix on March 13th, 2025. Melissa's a bit busy again this month, so she's asked me to step in and do this again, which I'm delighted to do. And Angry North was going to join me, but he's also tied up with business and life and all that stuff that stops us doing the really important things we really want to do. So you're stuck with me for the next hour or so. And I wanted to start off by following up a little bit on what Sam and Melissa were talking about a couple of weeks ago regarding how government are being portrayed as totally incompetent, particularly in the Western world, and how the public are beginning to view them as such, a complete clown show. What we've gone through the past 5 years should have, and well, I'm sure it did wake up a lot of people. And they've seen through a lot of the BS that came along with that. You know, you can only walk one way in the supermarket because apparently some bug in the air knows which direction you're walking and can infect you if you don't walk the right way. Step on these little pads and wait your turn because the little bug has a ruler, a measuring stick, and can tell how far away you are from one person to the other. Apparently. So it's quite a clever little bug. It does mathematics, it does, it can read a compass, etc. Which is probably more than half the politicians can do, actually, so I guess it's one up on them. But yeah, we've seen a total clown show over the past 5 years of so-called best of the best, eh? You know, we're told that these are the most intelligent people that we can get to run the country. And if I look back over my entire life, all I've seen is these buffoons destroying the country through their idiocy and actual incompetence. Which isn't a surprise really, is it? Because their job isn't to make your life better. It's to keep you under the cosh. Sometimes quite literally, with the brutality of the police forces, which we've also seen in the past 5 years. And which I'll come on to a little later regarding the German police. But it is deliberate. For sure it's deliberate, or they wouldn't show us it, or they wouldn't be acting this way. You know, we'd have intelligent people in there supposedly doing the right thing for the people. But even if they were doing the wrong things for the people, you would imagine that they'd do it in a far more intelligent way than they're doing, rather than right out of the open, psychopathic, full-on tyranny, wouldn't you? But no, it's right out in the open. You know, a boy's a girl's a boy, all that rubbish, global warming, blah blah blah, all the garbage of the day that these people keep spouting, regardless of any evidence, regardless of any facts. And as Alan would say, you know, facts don't matter when there's an agenda to follow. And we've seen it again all my life. I've seen the same thing. Everything gets worse. Nothing has ever improved personally in my life, thanks to government. That's for sure. Nothing. Everything that's come along in my life, good and bad, is on me, I'm afraid. You know, it's no politician had anything to do with it. Well, I guess, of course, they tax you to the hilt when they can get away with it. And I guess that's something they can enforce on you, regardless of what you do. At the end of the day, you've all got to buy food and stuff like that, clothes, which are all taxed, of course. And they spend it on stuff like, you know, sex changes for mice and all that kind of rubbish. We've got to study this because we need to know how it works in humans. Well, humans aren't mice, right? Or rabbits or guinea pigs. Well, I guess we are guinea pigs metaphorically. But, you know, we're not lab rats to be tested on, which is the way they seem to view us. But falling on with that, we could also say the same about Israel, couldn't we? Because Israel is being shown in the full glare of publicity to be absolutely brutal and sadistic and utterly evil in what they're doing. And you have to wonder how all these videos are coming out from these so-called soldiers. They're not soldiers, they're cowards. They're psychopathic cowards who I think if they came up against a real army, they'd run a mile. But they're very good at beating up children and women and stuff like that, you know, and bombing people from a distance who have done nothing to them. But we're seeing this, and you would imagine that those in the higher echelons of the Israeli military would stop these soldiers sending videos out. But no, it seems they're encouraged to do so. So there's got to be a reason behind that, because nobody in their right mind, and of course a lot of these people aren't in their right mind, they're utterly deranged, but they wouldn't be allowed to do it if it wasn't authorised from somebody more senior. So there's a reason for it, right? There's a reason we're getting to see it. Now, whether it's to acclimatise us to the fact that this is going to come to our door one day and we better just accept it, or whether it's to actually destroy people's belief in Israel. Even although virtually 100% of your governments are saying, rah, 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 go Israel, bomb the whole place, let's make it a Mediterranean resort. You know, Gaza Trump, or Trump Gaza, whatever they want to call it. But this is in the Jerusalem Post. And it should come as no surprise, really, that, so this is the headline, fewer than half of Americans sympathise with Israelis over Palestinians, poll shows. Sympathy for Israelis has dropped in the past few years as Israel has been led by a hardline right-wing government. Well, it doesn't seem to matter which government runs Israel. They carry on the same thing over and over again. They've been doing this for 75 years. You know, it wasn't always a hardline right-wing government. It was occasionally a hardline left-wing government. And they've got the same thing in common. They just want to slaughter Palestinians. So the whole hardline right-wing thing is just it's a smokescreen for the Israeli system, the Israeli establishment. Or should we call it the Jewish establishment? I don't know, because, you know, there's a large amount of Israelis who aren't Semites, shall we say. Fake Jews, I think they're called, in many corners. But anyway, this goes on. Fewer than half of Americans sympathise more with Israelis than with Palestinians, according to a new Gallup poll, the lowest figure for Israelis since at least 2001. You think they'd be more accurate than that. They think they'd actually know which year, wouldn't you? But it's the Jerusalem Post, and maybe they don't want to admit it. The poll published Thursday found that 46% of respondents sympathise more with Israelis, while 33% sympathise more with Palestinians. So what about the other 21%? Where did they go? The 13-point gap is also the smallest since at least 2001. That year, 51% of respondents sympathised more with Israelis, but only 16% sympathised more with Palestinians. Sympathy for Israelis has dropped in the past few years as Israel has been led by a hardline right-wing government. It's so important, that headline, that they had to say it twice. And since the Hamas attack on October 7th, which of course is a false flag, anybody with half a brain should have worked that out by now, fought a war against the terror group in Gaza with high numbers of casualties. I believe Hamas started off as a charity, actually, but it was created by Israel and is still funded to this day by Israel. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy there, you would think. It's Israel attacking itself, obviously. If they fund the group that they say attacked it, then they attacked it themselves, right? That's obvious again. Thursday's poll was taken in February, spanning the time when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, visited Washington DC and President Donald Trump proposed a US takeover of the Gaza Strip, which Netanyahu endorsed. Did he? He didn't look very happy about it. But I guess it's all just acting. A decade ago, 62% of respondents sympathised more with Israelis compared to 16% with the Palestinians. In 2022, the gap was 53-26. But they're always keen to point out that there's more people sympathising with Israelis, right? Even if it's only 46%. There's less support for Palestinians, so we must be right. Among Democrats, the drop this year was even starker, with the Palestinians receiving more sympathy by a wide margin. Just 21% say they sympathise more with Israelis, while 59% sympathise more with Palestinians. There's 20% missing there again. But of course, that's just a political thing, because the Republicans are all for it, all for the war and slaughtering innocent women and children, and men, of course. The Democrats have to be against it. That's the way that works. So it goes on. Polls show Israel losing sympathy. That's a considerable shift from 2022, when Democrats' sympathies were about even at 40% for Israelis versus 38% for Palestinians. Last year, it was 43% for Palestinians versus 38% for Israelis. Polls taken more than a decade ago show Democratic sympathies lying more with Israelis by wide margins. But of course, it's reversed, because they're not in charge anymore, and the other side supports it wholeheartedly, the slaughter. Thursday's number dovetails with a Gallup poll released in late February that found just 33%, there's that 33 again, of Democrats have a favourable view of Israel, compared with 83% of Republicans. This week's poll found that Republican sympathies with Israelis have remained relatively steady. That's 75% versus 10% for Palestinians. Among independents, the Israeli-Palestinian split was 42-34. So we all know that polls are there not to give you public opinion, but to create public opinion. And most people will go with the winners, right? That's why they finish the Jerusalem Post article at 75% support for Israelis and only 10% for Palestinians, because that's the way they want you to think. Despite the whole article being about Israel losing support, it ends on the positive, right? That the Republicans are hardline supporters of genocide. The poll also found that 55% of Americans and majorities of Democrats and independents support the establishment of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which of course are miles and miles apart. It's not a single landmass. Among Republicans, support for a Palestinian state was 41%. The poll also found that just 40% of respondents approve of the way President Donald Trump is handling the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Well, if the public actually realised that half the national debt of America has been given to Israel, maybe that'd be closer to 100%. Don't you think? Yeah, it's astonishing, isn't it? I can't remember, I saw it on a video the other day there, but they showed you how much money had gone to Israel over the decades and how much that had contributed to America's debt. Debt to who, I don't know, but there you go. Why should any government be in debt, right? They should be able to finance their own dealings. Anybody else would be bankrupt, of course. But 50% of their debt, of the American people, the American taxpayer, has gone to a foreign country. One single foreign country. Never mind all the other money that's gone to foreign countries. Can you imagine the amount of money that America would have? Can you imagine the wealth that could be created with all this wasted money? Most of it for wars, you know, to destroy countries and kill people. It's astonishing. And people put up with it. Death and destruction is just big business, isn't it? But we all pay for it. We're indirectly responsible for the deaths of these people in Palestine. We are, but unfortunately we have really not a lot of choice in the matter, because we're taxed every way we turn, and it's unavoidable, unless millions and millions of people just wake up one day saying, we're not paying tax anymore. You know, we're not paying sales tax anymore. We'll go in the store and we'll just leave the amount of money that we've calculated ourselves on the goods we purchase. You know, we stop paying our taxes for our cars. All of it. It's just, we're not supposed to be funding terrorist groups, right? That's illegal. Yet Israel founded Hamas and funds it to this day with American tax dollars, which is a crime, right? American taxpayers are funding what is portrayed as a terrorist organisation in Hamas, which Israel created. So, moving on, it's not just, they never mentioned the ages of the people who support one side or the other. but we'll just call it middle-aged for the sake of argument. But this article is from the Middle East Eye, and it says one-third of Jewish American teens say they sympathise with Hamas, Israeli government poll shows. So again, a poll from the Israeli government showing that a third of the Jewish American teens sympathise with the people they're supposedly fighting, who they funded through American loans, which shall never be repaid. Gifts, they call that. Survey shows 66% of Jewish teens in the US say they sympathise with the Palestinian people. I don't know where they get, they correlate one third to 66%. How's that work? I don't know. That they're conflating Hamas with Palestinian people, which is not the same thing, of course. That's what the Israeli government will tell you. They're all Hamas. More than one third of American Jewish teenagers between the ages of 14 and 18 agree with the statement, "I sympathise with Hamas," more than a year into Israel's war on Gaza, according to a new poll released by an Israeli government ministry. The survey by Israel's Ministry for Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism found that 36.7% of American Jewish teens either agreed or strongly agreed to the statement, "I sympathise with Hamas," Israeli media reported on Thursday. The number contrasted sharply with the 7% of Jewish teens living outside of the US who agreed with that statement. Well, they've been heavily propagandised, haven't they? By the media, I guess. But again, it doesn't really explain why the American number would be so high. I don't know. It doesn't really say what countries these Jewish teens were living in. Maybe they're in and around the Middle East, who knows? Probably in Israel. An even greater percentage of American Jewish teens, 41.3%, agreed with the statement that Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. Well, this 41.3% of American Jewish teens are absolutely correct. Only 10% of Jewish teens living outside the US agreed with that statement. A majority, 66%, said that they sympathise with the Palestinian people as a whole. Still, a significant majority of those polled said they had pro-Israel sentiments. 62% of American Jewish teens consider themselves to be Zionists. They wouldn't know what that is, would they? They're teenagers. These are people from the ages of, 14 to 18, and they know what Zionism is. Well, 84% said they believe Israel has the right to exist as a Jewish state. The survey comes more than... Well, I mean, take it back to where they came from. How about put them back in Ukraine? They can have it there. The survey comes more than a year after Israel began its war on Gaza, which started as a response to the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7th, 2023, which saw 1,200 people killed and over 200 taken as captives back to Gaza. And, of course, we now know, and it's been admitted by the Israeli IDF themselves, you know, the most, ethical army in the world, shot most of those people themselves. Because the Hannibal Directive was enacted, and the 200 captives taken back to Gaza, well, there's no evidence of that either. Throughout the course of the war, Israeli forces have attacked civilian residences, schools, UN shelters, hospitals and mosques, and killed aid workers, medical staff and journalists. But hey, that's not a war crime, right? So far, Israel's military has officially killed over 44,000 Palestinians, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza. I wonder who's feeding them the numbers. I mean, this was back in November last year, but the figures I've heard are anywhere between 500,000 and 800,000. So these figures are just nonsense again. However, the ministry has been heavily under-resourced over the past year, and some estimates from doctors within Gaza have put the death toll at more than 100,000. A study by The Lancet puts the figure at 186,000 or more. Well, as I say, 500,000 to 1,000,000 is the figure I've heard. Or 800,000. The war has led to mass pro-Palestinian protests on the streets of major US cities as well as on many university campuses. Many of these protests have been led in part by Jewish students. And again, These are Jewish students protesting against what's going on in Gaza, and you've got the likes of RFK Jr. coming out saying these people should be arrested and these protests banned because they're anti-Semitic. But they've been done by people who are supposedly Semites, right? Although I'm sure they're not. Middle East Eye reported earlier this year about the rise of anti-Zionism among young American Jews. Well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with being anti-Zionist? Is that not your political right to do that? The Israeli Ministry's survey says that young American Jews had weaker Jewish identities and called on pro-Israel Jewish organizations to target younger age groups to strengthen their Jewish identity and subsequently their connection to Israel. In other words, propagandize them heavily. Better get the nudge units in there, you know, and 8,200 Israeli intelligence people in there to sort that one out for them, because they're just not, walking the walk and talking the talk. Furthermore, the connection to Israel is weaker. They have less desire to visit Israel. Is that a surprise? They tend to support the Palestinian side in the war in Gaza, and their support for Israel increased only marginally following the events of October 7th, the survey's conclusion said. Well, perhaps because they can get more information here than they're ever going to get in Israel. Several polls in the US have indicated that while the majority of American Jews hold pro-Israel sentiments, a significant minority is critical of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. In 2021, polls showed that a quarter of American Jews agreed that Israel is an apartheid state, and a majority of them did not find that statement to be anti-Semitic. The reason why they might think the American Jews hold they're critical of Israel's treatment of Palestinians is probably because they're in classrooms with Palestinians and found them to be just ordinary folk. So getting back to where we started, Israel has certainly been portrayed as at the very least bad, right, even by its own supposed people, those chosen ones. But you've got to ask why. Is the plan to that Israel has to go eventually, which kind of goes against the greater Israel project? So I'm not sure. But if you can hear, that's a wind chime going in the background. It's got a bit windy here, and that hangs in the porch right outside my door here. Nothing to do about that except take it down, which I'm not going to do. So where does that take us? Well, let's stick with let's call them Semites, shall we? Of course, the owner of BlackRock would claim to be one of those people, Larry Fink. And this is from the New York Times on the... Oh, I don't see a date on this, actually. Oh, yeah, March 4th, 2025. After Trump applies pressure, Wall Street giant moves into Panama. An investor group led by BlackRock will acquire two ports near the Panama Canal that are owned by C.K. Hutchison and have been the subject of a dispute between President Trump and Panama. Now, what I heard the other day there was that BlackRock were planning to buy up all the ports on both sides of the Panama Canal, which would make it basically owned by BlackRock and by association owned by Semites and by association owned by Israel, making Israel great again. President Trump had been hammering Panama for weeks over its most valuable asset, the Panama Canal, saying without evidence that China operated the waterway. There seemed to be no way Panama could get Washington off its back. And so what if somebody else had been operating it? Why does that give you the right to go in and bully them and say, no, we want to operate it now, and we're going to give it to our Israeli bosses to do that for us? Maybe they'll bomb it. On Tuesday, Wall Street intervened. An investment group led by BlackRock, a giant American asset manager, said it had agreed to buy two ports in Panama owned by a Hong Kong company that had become the focus of the tensions between Panama and Mr. Trump. So here you have the corporations taking over the role of government, right? Or certainly interfering in it. BlackRock will buy the ports, which sit at either end of the canal, and over 40 others. There we go. 40 other ports from the Hong Kong conglomerate C.K. Hutchison for about $19 billion. That seems pretty cheap considering what they're going to get back. I would imagine. Though Mr. Trump has other complaints about the canal, it charges too much, he contends. What do you think that's going to change with BlackRock in charge? They'll just hold everybody to ransom, really. The deal greatly relieves pressure on Panama, political analysts said. It is an elegant off-ramp for, they've got to use boating terms, of course, for what looked to be an unsolvable crisis. Well, why was it a crisis in the first place? Said Benjamin Gidan, director of the Latin American program at the Windsor Center. I wonder if he's Jewish too. Certainly sounds it. The deal is also an indication of the spoils available to American companies as the Trump administration pursues its America First foreign policy. And for some historians, it brings up memories of the outsized power that Wall Street banks have had in Latin America. And the Benjamin Gidan fella is certainly Jewish, and he's a member of the Council of Foreign Relations as well. So there you go. Where are the Panamanian voices here? Said Peter James Hudson, an associate professor at the University of British Columbia and the author of Bankers and Empire, How Wall Street Colonized the Caribbean. They are completely lost in this larger story of Trump's efforts. Well, the colonizing of the Caribbean goes back to the days of Columbus. I mean, it's not a new thing. President Jose Raul Mulino of Panama appeared to downplay the geopolitical implications of the proposed acquisition, describing the deal in a social media post as a global transaction between private companies motivated by mutual interest. So it's nothing to do with us, right? It's nothing to do with the government. Oh, no, no, no. It's got a lot to do with the Israeli government, I suggest. For BlackRock, it's the latest sign of its desire to expand beyond what has historically been known for managing trillions of dollars for everyday investors in stock and bond funds. BlackRock is buying the ports through Global Infrastructure Partners, an investment firm it bought last year for almost $13 billion that owns and operates many ports, airports and data centres. So it's buying it through its own company. Well, what a surprise. The conversations between the BlackRock-led consortium and executives at CK Hutchison, which is owned by the Lee family, one of Asia's wealthiest, began a few weeks ago, according to a person familiar with the discussions. The Lee family believed it was under political pressure to exit the port's business, particularly its holdings in the Panama Canal, the person said. I wonder what kind of pressure that was. Get out or we'll take you out, maybe. The Panama Canal provides a crucial shortcut connecting the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. Vessels do not need to stop at Panama's ports to go through the canal. Not yet. They'll have to pay a toll eventually, I'm sure. Mr. Trump has frequently said he wants the United States to retake control of the waterway, which it ceded to Panama in 2000. C.K. Hutchison has operated the Balboa and Cristobal ports since 1997, when Panama granted the company 25-year concessions for the facilities. The concessions were renewed for another 25 years in 2021. The BlackRock Investment Group will be buying the companies that own the port concessions. So it's not enough that they're... I guess this is a roundabout way of getting the port concessions without actually having to apply for them. They just buy the company out. In the past several days, executives at BlackRock, including Lawrence D. Fink, its chief executive, and a board member, Adebayo Ogunlesi, briefed Mr. Trump, the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and others on the deal. According to two people involved in the deal, the administration was supportive, they added. I'm sure they were. The Lee family specifically sought an American buyer, one of the people briefed on the discussions said. Now, why would they do that when BlackRock is not American, right? There were three other bids for the deal, another person familiar with the deal said. Another person familiar, okay. So who said it? Frank Sixt, S-I-X-T, a co-managing director at CK Hutchison, said in a statement that the deal was purely commercial in nature and wholly unrelated to recent political news reports concerning the Panama ports. It's just a coincidence, right? This is BlackRock's largest infrastructure deal ever. It is doing the deal with a partner known as Terminal Investment Limited, which operates ports served by the world's largest container shipping company, Mediterranean Shipping. I'm sure if we looked into them, you'd probably find BlackRock's hands all over them too. The deal adds to Terminal Investment's portfolio of ports in Europe and Latin America, and in addition to operating ports in the Panama Canal, the buyers were particularly interested in CK Hutchison's ports in Asia. So here, these crowd are getting involved in buying all the ports of the world, right? All the important ones. Possibly where your food and everything comes in and out of, all your essential goods, medications, whatever. Mind you, if they stop them, that might not be a bad thing. But they're controlling the shipping of the world. And people don't see a problem, one company owning all that stuff. I'm sure they want to own all the airports as well, you know, all the roads, to facilitate essential travel only, I guess. These world-class ports facilitate global growth, Mr. Fink said in a statement. How? They're just taking them over so they can control them. How does control create growth? Seems the opposite. This deal also shows just how central Mr. Ogunlesi has become to BlackRock. After BlackRock acquired Global Industrial Partners, or GIP, Mr. Ogunlesi became the firm's largest individual shareholder. He separately sits on the board of Terminal Investment Limited. They're all in it together. BlackRock couldn't have done it without GIP, and GIP without BlackRock. Well, that goes without saying, right? The partners, said Ralph Schlossstein. He sounds Jewish too. Chairman Emeritus of the investment bank Evercore and a co-founder of BlackRock. The connectivity that Larry has with public sector leaders around the globe and the capabilities that Bio brings to the table are a compelling combination. The Trump administration's support of the BlackRock-led deal to buy these ports comes after Mr. Fink and the firm has been the target of many conservative lawmakers and politicians for his past comments urging corporations to consider environmental, social and governance, or ESG goals. You know, sustainable development, right? More recently, and particularly in recent weeks, BlackRock has stepped back from ESG and diversity initiatives. Go woke, go broke. I don't think that would apply to BlackRock. CK Hutchison is part of the conglomerate founded by Lee Ka-shing, who was Hong Kong's richest man at one point. Mr. Lee retired in 2018 and handed over control to his son, Victor Lee. Lee the Victor. The conglomerate includes retail chains, telecommunications networks, and energy companies. Mr. Trump has also taken aim at the fees that the Panama Canal charges shipping companies to use the waterway. The fees have gone up in recent years, but the Panamanian agency that runs the canal has said droughts, investments in upgrades, and sheer demand were responsible for the increases. How could the demand have gone up when the so-called COVID operation was going on and everything seemed to stop? Where was the demand? The port's concessions awarded to CK Hutchison in 2021 were recently challenged in a Panamanian court by two lawyers who contended that the concessions were unconstitutional. The lawsuit prompted speculation that the Panamanian lawyers behind the challenge were acting as a front for other entities who stood to profit from ousting CK Hutchison. I wonder who they could be. But Norman Castro, I wonder who he's related to. Who knows? One of the lawyers said in an email that he and the other lawyer were acting strictly in a personal capacity and out of respect for the country's constitution. Since when did these companies care about constitutions? The American government doesn't even care about its own. Panamanian authorities promised to conduct an audit to verify that Hutchison is properly reporting its revenues, payments and contributions on this to the state. On January 21st, nearly a dozen auditors entered the company's offices to begin their work. Mr. Molino said the audit would continue and help determine the relationship between the government and the port concessionaire. So they're going to investigate fascism, is that right? I doubt it. So, where does that take us? Well, it seems that BlackRock just can't keep their hands off war zones either. And they're all over Ukraine, of course. And this comes from our website called The Land Is Ours. I'm not sure if it's a Ukrainian website or not. It's all in English anyway. And this was on February 21st, 2023. War and theft, the takeover of Ukraine's agricultural land, exposes the financial interests of the dynamics at play, leading to further concentration of land and finance. The total amount of land controlled by oligarchs, corrupt individuals and large agribusinesses is over 9 million hectares, exceeding 28% of Ukraine's arable land. I think it's a bit more than that now. The last I heard was that BlackRock owned about 80% of the mineral rights in Ukraine. And I think Sam and Melissa alluded to that in their discussion as well, whereby apparently Zelensky said, oh, we've got a problem. Most of those assets are actually in Russian-held territory. And as Sam mentioned, well, we know where that's going to go, don't we? And that's why they want to keep the war going, perhaps. It's all about resources. The largest landowners are a mix of Ukrainian oligarchs and foreign interests, mostly European and North American, as well as the sovereign fund of Saudi Arabia. Prominent US pension funds, foundations and university endowments are invested through NCH Capital, a US-based private equity fund. And if I had thought about this, I would have read it beforehand and looked up to see who they were. But you can do that for yourselves. Several agribusinesses, still largely controlled by oligarchs, have opened up to Western banks and investment funds, including prominent ones such as Copernic, BNP or Vanguard. I'm sure BlackRock are in there somewhere because they own Vanguard and Vanguard owns BlackRock, who now control part of the shares. Most of the large landowners are substantially indebted to Western funds and institutions, notably the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and the World Bank. All the crooks, right? Western financing to Ukraine in recent years has been tied to a drastic structural adjustment program that has required austerity and privatisation measures, including the creation of a land market for the sale of agricultural land. President Zelensky put the land reform into law in 2020 against the will of the vast majority of the population, who feared it would exacerbate corruption and reinforce control by powerful interests in the agricultural sector. And they were absolutely correct, but did he care? No, because he's a dictator who is dictated to and does what he's told. I suppose we should call him a dictatee. Findings of the report concur with these concerns. While large landowners are securing massive funding, financing from Western financial institutions, Ukrainian farmers, essential for ensuring domestic food supply, receive virtually no support. Well, that's going on all across the world, the Western world for sure, India as well. And this is controlling the food supply. Now, as Kissinger said, you know, you control the food, then you control the people. Simple as that. And we'll all be on a diet, a specific calorific content, etc., 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 to make sure you're healthy, right? With the land market in place amidst high economic stress and war, this difference of treatment will lead to more land consolidation by large agribusinesses. The report also sounds the alarm that Ukraine's crippling debt is being used as a leverage by the financial institutions to drive post-war reconstruction towards further privatisation and liberalisation reforms in several sectors, including agriculture. You don't say. It's just like the IMF takeover of countries, isn't it? It's exactly the same script. You go and you get them totally in debt through, you know, all the weapons you've pumped in there to keep the war going, to make sure they stay in debt and need more weapons to continue the war, and you get more and more stuff off them by hook or generally by crook or crooks. The war in Ukraine has been at the centre stage of foreign policy and media reports since February 2022. Little attention, however, has been given to a major issue, which is at the core of the conflict: who controls agricultural land in the country known as the breadbasket of Europe? And isn't it funny? All this is going on behind the scenes while the country's at war, right? It would sound like it's planned, wouldn't it? This report addresses this gap, identifying the interests controlling Ukraine's agricultural land and presenting an analysis of the dynamics at play around land tenure in the country. This includes the highly controversial land reform that took place in 2021 as part of the structural adjustment program initiated under the auspices of Western financial institutions after the installation of a pro-European Union government following the Maidan revolution in 2014. Now, 2021, there was no war going on, right? So all this stuff was getting put in place by these crooks who knew the war was coming, which means that Putin was in on it, right? With 33 million hectares of arable land, there's that number again, Ukraine has large swathes of the most fertile farmland in the world. Misguided privatisation and corrupt governance since the early 1990s have concentrated land in the hands of a new oligarchic class. Around 4.3 million hectares are under large-scale agriculture, with the bulk 3 million hectares in the hands of just a dozen large agribusiness firms. And there's a little chart here of the companies from Luxembourg, Cyprus, USA, Netherlands, Saudi Arabia, and the 10th on the list is Ukrainian, who holds the least. In addition, according to the government, about 5 million hectares the size of two Crimea have been stolen by private interests from the state of Ukraine. I wonder who they are. The total amount of land controlled by oligarchs, corrupt individuals and large agribusinesses is thus over 9 million hectares, exceeding 28% of the country's arable land. The rest is used by over 8 million Ukrainian farmers. Now, if it's been stolen by private interests, then that's a crime, right? So why can't they just take it back and prosecute the people who stole it? The largest landholders are a mix of oligarchs and a variety of foreign interests, mostly European and North American, including a US-based private equity fund and the sovereign fund of Saudi Arabia. All but one of the 10 largest landholding firms are registered overseas, mainly in tax havens such as Cyprus or Luxembourg. So they're covering their backsides by registering in these countries, so you don't know who they are. Even when run and still largely controlled by an oligarch founder, a number of firms have gone public, with Western banks and investment funds now controlling a significant amount of their shares. The report identifies many prominent investors, including Vanguard Group, Copernic Global Investors, BNP Asset Management Holding, Goldman Sachs, owned NN Investment Partners Holdings, and Norges Bank Investment Management, which manages Norway's sovereign wealth fund. A number of large US pension funds, foundations and university endowments are also invested in Ukrainian land through NCH Capital, a US-based private equity fund which is the fifth largest landholder in the country. Most of these firms are substantially indebted to Western financial institutions, in particular the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the European Investment Bank and the International Finance Corporation, the private sector arm of the World Bank. Together these institutions have been major lenders to Ukrainian agribusinesses, which with close to $1.7 billion lent to just six of Ukraine's largest landholding firms in recent years. How are they ever going to pay that back? Other key lenders are a mix of mainly European and North American financial institutions, both public and private. Not only does this debt give creditors financial stakes in the operation of the agribusinesses, but also confers a significant level of leverage over them. Well, that was the plan, right? This was evidenced by the debt restructuring of UKR Land Farming, one of Ukraine's largest landholders, which involved creditors including the export-import agencies of the US, Canada and Denmark, among others, and led to important organisational changes, including layoffs of thousands of workers. That sounds a bit like Elon Musk's plans, right? That's a pretty long article, so if you're interested in that kind of thing, you could take a look at it yourself. But here's another one from Cosmo Online on the same topic, and this was written in 2024. The impact of investment giants in Ukraine and parallels with Kosovo. How much are natural resources a motive for war? Well, I think they're a very large motivation, don't you, when we see what's happening in Ukraine right now. Ukraine has fertile land, energy potential and rare minerals, which are very important in the development of high technologies. And who would be behind that, do you think? In Kosovo, there are significant coal reserves by European standards, but NATO primarily had its geopolitical goal in 1999. Well, it just wasn't about resources in Kosovo. They put in the only Muslim state within Europe, and they funneled arms and drugs, and I'm sure people through there on big aeroplanes and flew them all over the world. Independent candidate for US President Robert Kennedy Jr. recently stated that the conflict in Ukraine is led by the globalist business with the investment fund BlackRock at the helm. Few people understand that the war in Ukraine means for big business. It's not just about weapon procurement and reconstruction contracts. Ukraine's vast agricultural land, one of the most fertile in the world, is ripe for the taking, and American companies like BlackRock are at the forefront, Robert Kennedy wrote on social media a few months ago. Well, as I said, the previous article was written well before this, and it was already taking place. So Kennedy's a bit late to the party. In December 2022, as reported by the media at that time, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky struck a deal with BlackRock's CEO Larry Fink. Zelensky and Larry Fink agreed to focus in the near future on coordinating the efforts of all potential investors and participants in the reconstruction of our country, directing investments into the most relevant and effective sectors of the Ukrainian economy, states the announcement published on the website of the President of Ukraine. Now, again, this is in 2022, right? The war just started. So, I mean, what they're talking about reconstruction back then, and we're not even in the state that we're in today with Ukraine. It should be noted that the European Commission mentioned at the end of 2022 a figure of $600 billion needed for the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. How did they know that back then? When, as I say, the war's still going on now and it's 2025. So how did they come up with that estimate unless they knew exactly what was going to be destroyed, right? In the meantime, things have become more complicated, and this is increasingly being discussed by parts of the American public and media. Really, the public are discussing it, are they? Where? Most of them I see are saying, oh, why are we sending all that money to Ukraine? Thus, the editor and columnist of the American Conservative, Devlin Bradley, wrote a rather direct article in which he literally called BlackRock the buyer of Ukraine. I'll call them the thieves of Ukraine. According to the Statistical Review of World Energy conducted annually by British Petroleum, Ukraine has about 33 billion tonnes of coal, enough for 390 years of exploitation. Well, I think the UK has about 300 years worth of coal. I don't hear anybody talking about that. They destroyed that, didn't they? But now they want to take 33 billion tonnes of coal out of Ukraine. I thought coal was bad. It certainly is in Britain, because you're not allowed to have a coal fire. The Donetsk Basin, or Donbass, with its deep mines, covers 90% of Ukraine's coal production. Well, there you go, the Russians control it. Of course, significant amounts of other strategic resources on and under Ukrainian soil, like titanium, uranium and gas, are also mentioned. By comparison, Kosovo also ranks among the largest coal deposits in Europe, with an estimated more than 14 billion tonnes. It's been translated into English, this thing, so it's not quite accurate. While the situation regarding the war in Ukraine is very concerning and increasingly difficult for global security, again, it's Ukraine, right? Russia and Ukraine, why has this got anything to do with global security unless NATO gets involved, right? And they are involved and always have been. There are inevitable associations with what happened in Serbia in 1999. Well, maybe they'll overthrow Zelensky. The role of Trepka and Bond Steel. The real reasons why NATO decided to attack the then Federal Republic of Yugoslavia have been debated for 25 years, and it has long been clear that the story of humanitarian intervention due to the alleged endangerment of Albanians was just a convenient alibi for achieving other goals of US foreign policy at that time. And it always is, right? It's always an excuse. We've got to save them, so we'll bomb them for humanitarian reasons. Famous American economist and professor, I guess that's what the Israelis are doing in Gaza, right? It's humanitarian intervention. Famous American economist and professor at Columbia University, Jeffrey Sachs, said a few days ago that the goal of the NATO aggression on Yugoslavia was not to save the oppressed Muslim population in Kosovo, but rather to dismember Serbia to achieve America's goals. He is just the latest in a series of intellectuals in the West who have decided to speak openly about this. Well, as far as I understand it, Serbia wanted a big cut of what was going through their country, and America didn't want to give them it, so that's why they attacked them. What are the hidden interests of powerful political, military and financial circles when we talk about the NATO war for Kosovo's separation from Serbia, and how similar is this to the current events in Ukraine? Former Serbian Prime Minister Nikolai Sinovic believes that both the war in Kosovo in 1999 and the bombing of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, as well as Western involvement in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, are the result of America's ambitions to strategically position itself and establish military control closer to the east. The role of natural resources in Kosovo, he adds, is also not small. But of course, it's not America, right? It's not America's interests they're fighting for. It's the corporations that prop up the American state. Well, not prop up, but run it, basically. That's whose interests Trump seems to be looking after. The Larry Finks of this world and Benjamin Milikowski and Netanyahu. However, I believe that this was not decisive for the bombing and aggression against Serbia. Trepka represents a mining wealth for Serbia and the region, but it is almost invisible in Europe. Therefore, no war would be fought over it, because so much money was spent on that war that it could have bought both Trepka and the entire power industry, says Sinovic, for context. According to him, the main goal of the NATO pact in the Balkans was to reach the Black Sea. The mineral wealth of Kosovo, no matter how large, is not valuable enough to wage war over, especially considering that the US and Europe have economic mechanisms to obtain the necessary natural resources from any part of the world. Well, including their own. Including their own. They don't have to go abroad to get this stuff. There's more oil caps in America, more oil wells capped in America than there are open, probably. And Europe has the same thing. They could have all the oil and gas and coal they wanted from their own countries if they weren't going down the route of the green economy, which they've been told to go down by the UN, right? Who, of course, are part of NATO as well. War for resources is as old as humanity itself. In history, empires that have dominated entire continents have been the bearers of wars for resources. Tragically, even people were once considered resources. Well, we are. We are considered resources. That's why they call us human resources. This is certainly a characteristic of all wars, including those we are now discussing. However, the dominant aspect now is geopolitical, namely the control of space, primarily with a military motive to oppose the opposing force. Thus, controlling Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall is NATO's strategic goal that was aided by the collapse of the Soviet Union, explains Sinovich. Well, of course, it didn't collapse. It moved into its next phase, which was the open subversion of the rest of the Western world, which it had pretty much achieved by the time the wall came down. It just made it harder to... How can I put it, connect the two. When the wall came down, people were going, oh, the Soviet Union's been defeated, it's been defeated, it's over, communism's finished. Really? Communism's finished. Look what we went through in the past 5 years, that'll tell you a lot. All you need to know about communism not being finished and the tyranny that we're now under, if you care to look closely enough. And again, this article goes on quite a bit, so if you again are interested in this topic, then I suggest you go read it, and I'll include the links and everything in the video if I can work out how to do it. But there you go, that's just my technophobia coming in. Maybe I need Elon Musk to give me a hand, or Bill Gates, you know, those really smart guys that know, seem to know everything about everything, but actually know nothing. So where does that take us? How about, well, we're going to keep the Israeli connections going with things. And there's a video which I'm going to try and post of German police attacking a women's march in Berlin in support of Palestinians. And you can see these cops, I mean brutal cops, all padded out in their Kevlar, their helmets, their batons, their shields, everything, beating women in dresses, right, with these batons, digging them in the ribs with them. I'm sure that quite a number were injured on that. But I wonder why that would be. Do you think they're acting like that? And have been for quite a number of years. And we saw it in Australia, of course, during the COVID operation, and in other countries of the world, including the UK. German-Israeli cooperation, academic education for police forces. Academic, right? So they're just teaching them things, not tactics or physical brutality. They're not doing that, of course. Modern teaching and learning models, practice-orientated, in tune with the times, how academic training and further education for police forces can be designed, was the central topic of a German-Israeli police training exchange last week. An Israeli delegation of senior police instructors, accompanied by a representative of the Israeli Police Academy at Bet Shemesh, visited the German Police University, DH Paul, from 3rd to 8th of September 2023. With their stay, the Israeli delegation responded to the inaugural visit of the Vice President of the DH Paul, Mr. Uwe Markart, and the Head of Staff Unit 3 to the National Police in Israel in January 2023, immediately after the pandemic-related break. The mixture of science, research and practical work and history, practical police work and history. Pedagogical, pedagogical, is that how you pronounce it? Concepts and didactics, including hybrid teaching and learning models, provided the guests with an insight into training and further education at the DHPOL. German-Israeli research issues were also the subject of the multi-day exchange of information and experience. The training and further education of the North Rhine-Westphalian police and current discussions on issues of police ethics in North Rhine-Westphalia in the LAFP-NRW were reflected upon. They don't seem to have much ethics when they're beating up women in the streets of Berlin. The next day, the participants went to Duisburg to visit the innovation lab of the North Rhine-Westphalia police, which was newly opened at the end of 2022. It's funny how all these things are occurring, including what was going on in Ukraine with BlackRock and the Panama Canal and all that stuff. All that stuff was going on during the so-called pandemic, right? Weren't people supposed to be social distancing? But no, they're making multi-billion dollar deals in back rooms, drinking very expensive brandy, I would imagine. In the 500 square meter laboratory, or if they're all 6 feet apart, researchers are dedicated to the further and new development of future-orientated police technologies. During a visit to Munster Police Headquarters, the Israeli guests gained an impression of the challenges of practical police work. As a reminder and cultural obstacle, the week ended with a visit to the exhibition at Villa Ten Hompel, a historical site as well as a research and memorial centre for German police history. Now, the future-orientated police technologies are actually current orientated police technologies in Israel, in case you haven't seen them. At all the checkpoints they have between what was once Gaza and the so-called Israeli border, they have machine guns which are operated by AI. And if they don't like the look of your face as they facially scan you, the thing will just shoot you. That's your future dash current orientated police technologies they're sharing. Well, you gotta wonder why the German police would need that, right? Or any police would need it. We appreciate the constructive and open dialogue with our colleagues from Israel to advance academic police training across borders, says Karsten Twellmeyer, head of staff unit 3, international cooperation at the DHPOL. Strengthening relations between the German and Israeli police authorities promotes trust and cooperation between the two countries and makes it possible to expand existing networks, intensify long-term partnerships and develop joint research projects, as Guido Katert, Deputy Head of Staff Unit 3, the international cooperation and responsible for DHPOL's contacts with Israel. Isn't it ironic, right, that the Germans and the Israelis are now best buddies? As if they were really ever enemies in the first place, right? So yeah, I'll try and get that video posted with the police brutally attacking defenceless women in dresses in the streets of Berlin. We're talking about future technologies that are already here. AI. Now, a lot's been said about AI, right? And I don't think it's that bright. And I've said that before. It's just repeating things that's been taught, and it's going through information that's been given, and it's coming to the conclusion that the people who programmed it want it to come to. It's quite simple. That's why it's called artificial. But a lot's been made, of course, of coming blackouts, right? We can't be doing all these electric cars because we don't have the grid that will be able to cope with it. In all these Western countries, they're all saying the same thing. This is stupidity. We can't deal with this. We're having power cuts as it is. What are you doing? We've got all these immigrants coming into our countries demanding houses, and that's more electricity and more, and they're all wanting electric cars and all blah, 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 blah. But we can't hack it. But this is Ireland. And Ireland's electricity crisis, AI data centres to consume one third of national grid by 2026. So I guess the blackouts are going to start pretty soon, right? In Ireland and the rest of the world where they're doing this. By 2026, Ireland's electricity grid will face unprecedented strain as data centres, driven by the explosive growth of artificial intelligence, are projected to consume 33%, there's that number again, it just crops up in every article you seem to read, of the nation's power supply, with approximately 130 data centres expected to be operational by then. The surge in energy demand is largely fuelled by international tech giants like Amazon, Microsoft and Google. While the Irish government, through the Irish Development Authority, champions these developments as critical to the nation's digital economy, critics argue that the benefits disproportionately serve transnational corporations rather than Irish citizens. And I'll add that it's all to spy on you, the Irish taxpayer who's having to pay for all this stuff. It's all on you. It's all spying on you. Every bit of it is about gathering your data, and possibly, you know, the next time you drive through some kind of checkpoint somewhere in any country in the world, some automatic AI powered machine gun will just take you out. But hey, taxation without representation is a thing of the past, isn't it? We don't care about that anymore. I say that to Americans all the time. You fought a war against supposedly the greatest army in the world at the time, the British Army, over a 2% tax on tea, and you're putting up with this garbage that's going on now, with billions and billions and billions of dollars going over the world for things that you know nothing about, given to foreign dictators, you know, gay comedians pretending to run a country, and savage genocidal maniacs in the Middle East. And at the same time, you're funding the terrorists that they're supposed to be fighting as well. But hey, taxation with representation, right? What do we care about that? While the Irish government, through the Irish Development Authority, champions these developments as critical to the nation's digital economy, whoever asked for it? Whoever asked for the digital economy? Critics argue that the benefits disproportionately serve transnational corporations rather than Irish citizens. This raises urgent questions about energy equity. Energy equity. That's it. Everybody gets a little bit, right? Nobody gets what they need. National infrastructure and the long-term sustainability of Ireland's energy policies. Well, if they're allowed access to oil and gas that's right off their coast, maybe they wouldn't have a problem. But multinational corporations have bought all that stuff as well and exported it to other countries. The rise of data centres and the AI boom. The rapid expansion of data centres in Ireland is inextricably linked to the global rise of AI technologies. According to the International Energy Agency, Irish data centres will consume a staggering 33% of the country's electricity grid by 2026. That 33% number was so good they had to put it in here twice. Currently, Ireland hosts between 82 and 95 data centres, with dozens more under construction or in the planning stages. Well, why are they giving them planning permission when they know they can't power them? Why don't they insist that the people putting them in, like Amazon, Microsoft and Google, actually supply the electricity themselves? How about that for a novel approach? They could put up big wind farms on the land that they're building these things on and power them with that, right? By 2026, this number is expected to reach 130, cementing Ireland's status as a European hub for data storage and processing. Yeah, they'll be working fine, but the rest of the country will be in darkness and they won't be able to turn on their heating or anything. But hey, it's an international centre for data storage and processing. I wonder whose data they're storing and processing. Is it going to be the whole of Europe's or something? Well, the Irish government and the IDA frame this, that's the International Development Association or something, this growth as essential for economic development. Well, it sounds like it's going to be essential to bring the country to its knees because they won't have any energy. The reality is more complex. A report by international law firm Mason, Hayes and Curran highlights that AI has significantly driven the demand for data centre capacity, noting that the scale and power requirements of these facilities have grown exponentially as AI technologies expand globally. Yet public discourse often glosses over the role of AI, instead emphasising the role of data centres in supporting everyday digital activities like streaming or online shopping. Oh, that's what we really need. You can't do much streaming or online shopping when you've got no electricity, folks. Right? Whether you realise it or not, every streaming show you watch, every match you make on Tinder, so you can't go on your dating site either when you've not got any power. Think about that, guys and girls. You know, what are you going to do then? You might have to go out and meet people in person. My, that'd be terrible, wouldn't it? And every flight you book is facilitated by a data centre, wrote RTE Brainstorm in April 2024. They're so intelligent. RTE, that's the BBC of Ireland, and it's a programme called Brainstorm. It doesn't take a genius to work this out, does it? But they've got to put a programme on it, a special programme on it, just so you get the point. But the fact is that We were already doing this stuff before, right? We were doing this years ago. We were booking flights online. I've been doing it for like 20 years, and it wasn't a problem. We didn't need all these big data centers to do that. While technically accurate, this framing obscures the larger truth. Ireland's data centers primarily serve the profit-driven needs of transnational corporations, not the Irish public. Well, when did the Irish government ever do anything for the Irish public that served their best interests? Or any other country for that matter? Is America really going down the route of America first? It seems to be all about Israel first, as far as I can see. Going back to where I sat with the Panama Canal, it's going to be Israeli owned and Israeli run, I would say. That seems pretty obvious, and America's going to get nothing out of it. Maybe Trump will get a big kickback, and other politicians that support it, of course, big brown envelopes. The ownership of that, or they won't release the big brown envelopes with all the photographs and film of them molesting children. Maybe that's part of the deal. The ownership of Ireland's data centres reveals a landscape dominated by international tech giants and institutional investors. Amazon Web Services, AWS, leads the pack with 34 data centre sites across the country, consuming enough electricity to power between 120,000 and 140,000 homes. So if you're in one of those, let's call it 130,000 homes next to the data centres, you're in trouble. Microsoft operates 12 facilities, while Google and TikTok each run two. So you've now got the Chinese in there as well. So they're benefiting from it, but the Irish people aren't. These companies have sought to offset their energy consumption by investing in Irish wind farms, entering into power purchase agreements, PPAs, to secure renewable energy without directly owning the infrastructure. So they don't have to maintain it either, right? Public-private partnership. The taxpayer will have to pay for all this stuff as well, to supply this so-called renewable energy, which will never run these data centres at all. And they'll be sitting in the dark. For example, Amazon has invested in wind farms in County Cork, 23 megawatts, County Galway, 115 megawatts, and County Donegal, pending review. However, critics argue that this creates a circular problem. Transnational corporations drive the need for more electricity, then invest in renewable energy projects to meet that demand, effectively privatising Ireland's energy resources. So they want to control the food, they want to control the energy, the water, of course. What's left for the Irish people? They're taking the land as well. So what have you got left? And you ain't getting any of it, by the way. You're going to be rationed on all of it. Smaller co-location data centres operators like Equinix, Echelon Data Services and Vantage Data Centres also play a significant role. Equinix, which operates 6 data centres in Ireland and plans to build a 7th, guess what, is largely owned by institutional investors such as Vanguard, BlackRock and State Street. Well, who'd have thought? These facilities host a wide range of clients from software giants like Adobe and Microsoft to telecom providers like AT&T and Deutsche Telekom. So all these foreign interests are in there sucking up all the electricity, giving a pittance to windmills, and the Irish people are sitting in the dark, in the cold, and getting all their data harvested to keep them under control. What a deal, eh? I keep asking my Irish friends, when's the rebellion going to start? When is the second Irish rebellion going to start? Because if they're not careful, it'll be too late. You know, they can't have guns or anything there, of course, but you know, the old pitchforks and fires and all that kind of stuff. They need to do something. They need to do something before the hordes of African immigrants are given police uniforms and told to go out and beat their heads. The construction of data centres has become a lucrative sector in Ireland, with companies like Winthrop Technologies leading the charge. Founded in 1995, Winthrop has grown into one of Europe's largest data centre construction firms, with projected 2024 revenues of €2 billion. In April 2024, private equity firm Blackstone, I think that's part of BlackRock as well, isn't it, acquired a majority stake in the company for over $800 million, signalling the growing value of data centre infrastructure. If Blackstone has invested over $800 million into a company with revenues of $2 billion, you know that $2 billion figure is going to skyrocket, because that's a big investment for what looks like a small return, because there's obviously other investors who are going to take a cut of that. Winthrop's projects include a 96 megawatt data centre in Dublin and multiple other facilities across the capital. While the construction sector benefits from this boom, the long-term economic value of data centres to Ireland remains questionable. As the IDA itself acknowledges, data centres should be assessed in the context of the total economic value they bring, including their role in supporting the broader data economy. However, critics argue that the primary beneficiaries are the transnational corporations that own and operate these facilities, not the Irish public. A looming electricity famine. It's interesting to use the word famine, right? Isn't it? We know what happened back then. It wasn't a famine at all. It was an artificially created starvation tactic, shall we call it, by the British, who stole all the food from Ireland and sent it to their armies abroad. Well, is this any different? Is this any different? Ireland's data centre boom raises profound questions about the nation's energy future. As electricity prices rise and the grid struggles to meet demand, ordinary households face increasing strain. Recent storms, such as Storm Owen, or Ewan, exposed the fragility of Ireland's infrastructure, leaving many without power for weeks. Yet data centres, massive consumers of electricity, remained largely unaffected, highlighting a stark disparity in energy access. So there's nothing wrong with their buildings, right? So why can't they build houses with the same integrity and structure as they build the data centres? So the houses keep the lights on, right? The Irish government's support for data centres reflects a broader trend of prioritising corporate interests over public needs. By 2026, the nation's electricity grid will be stretched to its limits, with one third of its capacity dedicated to powering data centres owned by international tech giants. This raises the spectre of a tech-induced electricity famine, where Irish households and businesses bear the brunt of an overburdened grid, whilst transnational corporations enjoy guaranteed supply. Well, they have to have guaranteed supply because they can't keep all that data on you unless they do, right? And they can't use it against you in real time because they need it active. In the end, Ireland's data centre policies may represent a Faustian bargain, trading land, energy and infrastructure for the promise of economic growth. Well, we've heard that before. Oh yeah, things are going to get better. Things are going to get better. When I lived in Ireland and we went to what was called the Celtic Tiger, I don't know where they got that term from, I never saw any evidence of it whatsoever. None. Only to see the benefits flow overwhelmingly to absentee corporate landlords. As the nation grapples with this imbalance, the question remains, who will power Ireland's future, its people or its data centres? Well, as I say, they need to start picking up pitchforks, hammers, anything to start taking their country back, because otherwise they're done for. I think they're pretty much done for now, but, well, as I say, they're going to have to do something. The people are going to have to wake up and do something. And this goes for every country, of course, America in particular. I think if the American public actually woke up to what was going on and realised that the whole political system was just a circus, like Melissa and Sam alluded to, it's just the Wrestling Federation entertainment wing of or political entertainment of your larger entertainment industry. That's all it is, entertainment. It's two teams supposedly fighting each other, which of course they're not. They're all on the same page. So let's move on to RFK Jr., shall we? It's taken me nearly 4 hours to do just over an hour of audio, and mainly due to interruptions because of autism, severe autism. And that involves broken windows, smashed up doors, you name it, it happens in this house. Just mayhem. But RFK Jr. of course is now endorsing the MMR shot, which he's clearly linked to autism, and now he's encouraging parents to get it for the children. Now, when I saw that, you know, yeah, it wasn't unsurprising. He didn't get in that government to not toe the line. When you get in bed with the father of the vaccine, right, and he still claims to be so, Mr. Trump, right, when you get into bed with that guy, then you're on the same page as that guy, quite clearly. And statements that he made there regarding the MMR just prove that. After all the years he's supposedly been fighting against these things, oh, I'm not anti-vaccine, I just want safe vaccines. Well, he knows for a fact that the MMR is not safe. And you can perhaps hear in the background some more autism related noise. But I'm just going to leave it there so people understand what it is that these things cause. And if he comes up here and starts banging the door, I'm going to leave that in as well. But yeah, you hear people talking about they'd rather the kid got autism than measles. Really, really, they've clearly never experienced autism. And probably never experienced measles either. They might find out that it just gives you a little bit of a rash and it's gone in a week or so, and your child is protected for life from ever getting it again. But anyway, here's something else wrong with the MMR, and I'm sure Kennedy knows this as well. This is from the 5th of March 2025 from Anna Maria Mihailsia, MD, PhD, and from the Humanity United Now website, I think it is. Yeah, not, oh, it's from our own Substack, sorry. Measles, mumps, rubella and varicella vaccine for children shows nanowatt swarms, quantum dots and self-assembly hydrogel. And this is reposted. So this was done well before March the 5th. So I'm sure Kennedy knows all about this as well while he's promoting this poison. Given the recent discussion about MMR vaccination, I wanted to repost this analysis I did in September 2023. So it's, you know, a year and a half ago, nearly. When considering vaccine safety, microscopy analysis should be considered, as many of the findings we see in the blood can be identified to self-assemble in childhood vaccines. And a little, got a little subheading in there. From that, I think it was a New York Post article, was it? Or Fox News article. RFK Jr. suggests parent consider measles vaccine amid deadly Texas outbreak. But he knows full well there is not a single measles vaccine either. And actually, in that Fox News article, it showed you a vaccine vial with the word measles on it. Total disinformation, because there is no such thing as a single measles vaccine. So he knows this is a lie. It's a call to action, the Texas outbreak. The decision to vaccinate is a personal one, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wrote in an opinion piece published Sunday on Fox News Digital. The childhood MMR vaccine is loaded with nanobots. They are so small that on my highest magnification you can barely see them, but they are clearly there. I tried to go up to 4,000 times with my oil objective, but could not visualise them. I took many videos, and if you look at the entirety of the documentation, it is clearly stunning. The MMRV vax is supposed to be stored at minus 56 Fahrenheit. Thawed, it looks exactly like the C-19 bioweapon. Filaments do assemble and large areas of hydrogel construction. Without a cover slip, the self-assembly is much more visible. This is given to 9-month-old babies, then again at 15 months, and then at 6 years of age. This is the fifth childhood vaccine I looked at. It all looks the same to me. It is loaded with self-assembly nanotechnology. And you've got to ask the question, how long has it been in there? Was it in there before 2019? Have children been getting this already? Perhaps not in large demographic areas, maybe not as much as the COVID bioweapon was. But perhaps it was done on an experimental basis in different areas of the country or the world. Maybe countries we're not getting data from to see what it would do. And I've always thought that, you know, when something has to be stored at something like minus 56 degrees Fahrenheit, and remember, freezing point in Fahrenheit is plus 32 degrees. So this is pretty cold stuff. It's supposed to be stored at minus 56 Fahrenheit for a reason, because it's either dangerous above that, or it's useless at the function it's desired to have. Now, if it was useless for its desired function, which is clearly nefarious, how come if somebody injects you with something at minus 56 Fahrenheit, it's going to cause you a problem right at the injection site, right? Because it's going to thaw out, it's going to try and thaw out as soon as it gets in your body, but if it's minus 56 Fahrenheit, it's going to take a little bit of time for that to thaw out, you would think. And then what? Is that when it becomes dangerous? Who knows? You can see that there's a couple of videos she's included in here. You can see that the liquid is dense and many layers of activity are seen, including larger hydrogel pieces. I wanted to show the minuscule swarming in the background that is clearly involved in self-assembly. A human red blood cell has about a diameter of 6.8 micrometers. I would say these nanobots are at least 1,000 times smaller than that. This is how far the technology is, right? And as Melissa and I have discussed, and other people on the broadcast that she's done, Elon Musk saying he's going to put something in your brain the size of a quarter is a joke, right? It's a joke when you see the size of these things. Larger pieces of hydrogel can be seen moving in the extremely busy background. The entire drop was moving towards the centre, clearly coordinated intelligently to build a large hydrogel-like clot. In this video, you can see 100 times magnification with clear movement. It looks just like insulin that I filmed. Here you can see, after about 45 minutes, how much of this has already assembled and how much coordinated movement there is. And it goes on, there's a series of videos here. Quite a lot of videos, actually. So let's skip down to the summary. Given the new discussions around measles vaccination, one aspect of ensuring safety is to also assess the microscopy evidence. And there's other links to other studies which have been done on microscopic vaccine analysis. So yeah, if you're interested in that topic, there's plenty there to take a look at. But the Amish are now under attack regarding vaccinations. And the title here is from the Courthouse News Service. Second Circuit eradicates Amish fight over New York school vaccination mandate. A New York State law requiring school immunizations does not violate the constitutional rights of Amish parents or their school-aged children. In other words, they're just overriding it, right? They do have the rights, but the courts also bought and paid for, as we should all know by now. A New York State law requiring Amish students to receive vaccinations does not violate those students' constitutional rights, a Second Circuit panel ruled Monday. The case, which the panel heard this past November, had been brought by three Amish community schools that were fined in 2019 for failing to comply with state-mandated school vaccinations. The schools and Amish parents argued their First and 14th Amendment rights had been violated, as many Amish seek to live separately from the modern world and abhor vaccines. Well, I wish I could live away from the modern world in a forest somewhere, a little farm or something. New York had since 1966 allowed exemptions from mandatory school immunization for medical reasons or sincerely held religious objections. However, following a nationwide measles outbreak in 2018 and 2019, the legislature removed these exemptions, joining four other states to prohibit any kind of non-medical exemption. Well, how about they're dangerous? How about that for a reason for exemption? Can't you simply come out and say, hold on a minute, I've read the insert from this product, and in my educated opinion and my informed consent right, then I don't want it. Thank you very much. That's perfect common sense. I don't know why courts have to get involved in that. If you read any vaccine insert and you're halfway intelligent, you're not going to take it, right? You're not. Shortly after the new rule was passed, the Dygert Road School, Pleasant View School and Shady Lane School were fined tens of thousands of dollars each for violating state law after they refused to comply with the law. The schools and several board members sued the state for an injunction. In 2024, US District Court Judge Elizabeth Wolford, a Barack Obama appointee, dismissed the complaint. Just dismissed it, right? It's not important. She found the facts of the New York case were similar to another complaint held in Connecticut that also had been thrown out on a finding of no constitutional violations. Whatever happened to this thing called human rights? That's got nothing to do with the Constitution. That's your body. My body, my choice. What happened to that? In a 28-page ruling, the trio of Second Circuit judges upheld Wolford's dismissal, citing the Connecticut case and also finding the New York law did not run afoul of a landmark US Supreme Court ruling from the 1970s that prohibited compulsory education of Amish children past middle school. They've got to get them in the indoctrination camp. The court found the analogy to the Wisconsin v. Yoder case incongruous, noting New York's vaccine rule would not forcibly remove Amish children from their community at the expense of the Amish faith or the Amish way of life. Well, unless they're not vaccinated, maybe. The court noted that medical exemptions are typically tailored to a specific immunization, while religious exemptions apply to all vaccinations. Well, again, if you read the inserts, all of these shots have similar, if not identical, problems. So I don't think specific immunizations, as they'd like to call them, come into it. They're all dangerous. The religious exemptions sweep had a far greater ability to undermine the state's interest in preventing the spread of disease, the court said in its per curiam opinion. Well, again, we've seen, particularly over the last 5 years, that the thing they rolled out supposedly to stop the spread of the deadly disease, which wasn't deadly, didn't work. And they admitted it. Further, allowing religious exemptions caused clusters of low vaccination rates and an inability to achieve herd immunity in certain communities, the court wrote. I thought herd immunity was bogus, they told us, didn't they? Attorney Shannon Denmark of Lehotsky Keller Cohn, I'm sorry to say it, but that sounds Jewish as well, who represented the Amish schools and families, did not respond to an email seeking comment by press time. I wonder if she's a Trojan horse. An email seeking comment from the New York State Solicitor General attorney, who argued before the Second Circuit, also was not immediately returned. The panel included US Circuit Judges Jose Cabranes, a Bill Clinton appointee, Eunice Lee, a Joe Biden appointee, and Richard Wesley, a George W. Bush appointee. And as I said before, they're all in it together. So, shall we finish there? Or we'll finish with this last one, because it kind of ties in some of what we've been talking about. I don't know if I'll read the whole thing, but yeah, I may do. I don't think it's that long. Oh, it actually is that long. We'll see how far we get. This is called... it's from a website called Eric Wickstrom Substack, and it's called Checkmate, the Triumph of Technocracy, How Trump, Elon and the Tech Elite are Paving the Way for a Brave New World and What It Means for All of Us. And this is from February 15th, 2025. I invite you to temporarily set aside your preconceptions about how the world works. I know this may run counter to everything you believe, everything you think you know about what's happening in our world. The truth goes much deeper than the surface level chaos we see in the headlines. I sincerely hope I'm wrong about this analysis. In fact, I pray that I am. But if I'm even partially correct, we are witnessing one of the most sophisticated power grabs in human history. Introduction. We are living through a historic transition of power, the shift from a corrupt facade democracy to an AI-driven technocracy controlled by Silicon Valley billionaires. And I would say also Big Pharma, Big Media, and big agriculture. While this unfolds, most observers are, as usual, focused on the wrong signals, missing the larger pattern of what's actually happening. And what's happening isn't isolated to the United States, it's a global agenda that will reshape every aspect of our lives. What makes this moment unique isn't just the scale of the transformation, but its inevitability. Well, I don't think it is inevitable, to be honest. I think, well, maybe it is. If people actually woke up to what was going on, it could be stopped. The technological infrastructure required for total control has finally matured. Artificial intelligence has reached the sophistication necessary for algorithmic governance. That's a good term, algorithmic governance, which means everything you're supposed to do and don't do will be spotted because the algorithm will pick it up and you will be punished softly or perhaps a bit more hard. The social and political chaos we're experiencing isn't random. It's orchestrated to create the perfect conditions for this transition, which is where we started off, I think. I didn't plan this, so I hadn't read this article before, but there you go, synchronicity, right? Consider this. Elon Musk alone controls enough wealth to simultaneously fund 8 Manhattan projects, maintain a private army of 100,000 elite mercenaries for a decade, or fund the entire United Nations for 14 years. I'm sure he'd probably love to do all of that. But this isn't about money, it's about power. The tech elite already have more wealth than they could spend in multiple lifetimes. What they're pursuing is something far more ambitious, total control over society's future development. Well, society's future in totality. The genius of the strategy lies in its complexity. Like a masterfully played chess game, every move serves multiple purposes. What appears as chaos is actually a precisely choreographed sequence of events. What looks like resistance is often part of the plan. Even this analysis, should it reach a wider audience, would likely be dismissed as paranoid speculation, which is exactly what makes this strategy so effective. I see tremendous potential in the revolution unfolding around us. The promise of AI, the possibility of more efficient and just governments, the dream of liberation, these are all within our reach, but I fear we're being led down a darker path, one that uses these same technologies to establish unprecedented control rather than freedom. I kind of disagree with that because I don't think AI is a good thing for anything. I don't think we need it. I don't think it's what people want. And I think it's always potentially going to be dangerous, whether it's supposedly put to good use or bad. I don't see any potential for it to be to create more efficiency and certainly not just governance. And the dream of liberation, I don't see that being a thing at all. AI is not meant for any of that. It's meant for control. In this analysis, I'll attempt to decode the pattern behind what's happening, reveal the philosophical blueprint guiding these changes, and expose the systematic implementation already underway. The insights come from hundreds of hours studying elite writings, tracking their actions, and mapping the connections between seemingly unrelated events. What emerges is a picture both fascinating and terrifying. A coordinated effort to fundamentally restructure society using Trump as a tool, democracy as a stepping stone, and artificial intelligence as the ultimate instrument of control. The most crucial question isn't whether this transformation is happening, it's whether we can recognise it in time to influence its direction. Well, it's already happening. It's already happening. And that's pretty obvious. Let's begin by examining how we got here and why this moment in history provides the perfect conditions for what's about to unfold. Part 1. The perfect storm, setting the stage. What began with subtle changes in society's foundation has revealed itself as something far more calculated. The growing polarisation, the accelerating technological revolution, the institutional breakdowns, none of these were random events. They formed the opening moves in a transformation so ambitious that even describing it risks sounding implausible. The blueprint. Three elements converged to create the perfect conditions for change. First, a strategic erosion of trust. Government agencies making decisions that seem designed to undermine their own credibility. Media organisations abandoning even the pretense of objectivity in ways that destroyed their authority, or their believability, of course. Political processes long ago devolved into such obvious theatre that they undermine the entire system's legitimacy. Second, a precise channeling of public frustration. Rather than focusing on specific targets, anger fragmented and turned inward against the society itself. Left and right polarised beyond dialogue. Different social groups found themselves in perpetual conflict. Each attempt at reconciliation or compromise failed in ways that deepened divisions, because that was always the intention. Third, the emergence of technology sophisticated enough to enable total control. For the first time in history, the technical capability exists to implement governance through algorithms, monitor populations comprehensively, and automate resource allocation across entire societies. The formula. This transformation follows a classic pattern: problem, reaction, solution. Problem: create or amplify problems severe enough that the population demands change. Reaction: wait for the reaction, frustration, anger, calls for reform. Now think of everything that's going on, particularly around the immigration thing. Think what the solution to that's going to be. Solution: present solutions that would never be accepted under normal circumstances. Again, the immigration thing, what do you think they're going to do there? They can't get these people out of their countries anymore. So they're going to have to somehow assimilate them into society, which I don't think is possible. Or they're going to have to use them against society, which is definitely possible. The execution of this formula shows remarkable sophistication. Each crisis connects to the next. Every institutional failure creates specific vulnerabilities. Each scandal opens the door for predetermined solutions. And it goes on to the hidden pattern. Actually, I'll read this last little bit here, and I think it's quite a long article, and I might actually, if I do this again, if need be, I'll start at the next part of it and finish it, because as I say, it's probably another 20 minutes of reading, and we're already an hour and a half into this. So anyway, I'll finish on this part, the hidden pattern. What makes this moment unique isn't just these individual elements, but their perfect synchronization. The technological capability has matured exactly as social structures weaken and power concentrates in the hands of those with a specific vision for humanity's future. And of course, they're the ones that control AI. Consider how each aspect reinforces the others. Digital platforms replace traditional information sources, just as trust in media collapses. AI systems emerge as alternatives to human judgment, right as faith in institutions fail. So we've to give away our capacity to make decisions to a computer, which is programmed by the people who want to control society. What could possibly go wrong? Private infrastructure displaces public services precisely when government credibility hits historic lows. So there we are, full-on fascism, right? This isn't coincidence. These changes follow a design so precise that it remained invisible until its effects became almost irreversible. Like a master chess player's strategy, the true pattern only becomes clear when the position is already won. And I think Alan's mentioned that many, many times. There's never a move made on the chessboard until every move is predetermined in advance to get them to where they want to go on any particular subject area or topic or plan. It's all worked out in advance. I'll actually finish this off because the part two goes on to Trump's role in all this, and that's probably a good place to start next time. The stakes. We're witnessing more than a political realignment or technological revolution. This is a fundamental restructuring of society, a transformation that uses our legitimate frustrations with failing systems to implement something far more controlling. The true scope of this change remains hidden because its architects speak in the language of progress, efficiency, and innovation. They present each step as a natural evolution rather than what it is, a calculated move toward a new form of social organisation. To understand how this transformation operates in practice, we need to examine its most visible manifestation, the carefully orchestrated performance centred around Donald Trump. And as I say, I mean, you can finish this article on your own if you want to, but I think I'll start back here if I do this again, or we'll discuss it on air with Melissa. So I'm going to leave it at that, and apologies if this appears a bit or sounds a bit disjointed. This is the 11th segment I've recorded in over 4 hours due to interruptions caused by the MMR shot. I'll leave it at that. If you got this far, thanks for listening, and I will try and put a video together for this. How successful that'll be, I'm not quite sure, but I'll give it a go. So, thanks for putting up with it. Cheers.